I'd like to say thank you for inviting me to present at this conference with a bunch of surgeons. I think you're very brave. I don't have any financial disclosures, but I do have another disclosure. I am a psychologist, and I get it. Sometimes people just don't like talking to me. And in fact, this says, look, call it denial if you like, but what I think what goes on in my own personal life is none of my own damn business. So you're a surgeon, and you may think it's not your job. Take a look. But it's a new world, and there are new demands being placed on surgeons. We're in the process of moving from the strictly medical model, which looks at what's going on with patients in the periphery, and if we can just fix that, the patient will get better, to the biopsychosocial model, which takes into account the entire person. When I see my patients and I describe to them that that's why my job was invented, it makes them kind of happy. They like being treated as entire human beings. So we're asking that we now all become team players. This has been always true, I believe, in the military and in the VA. They know that that the team is the way we have to operate. But it's kind of a new demand that's being placed on a lot of other providers. We now are being asked to listen to what the patient actually wants. In the talk yesterday afternoon by Dr. Gawande, he told a story about his father, who finally, somewhere along the line in his own treatment, was asked, what is it that you want from your life? And how can we help you achieve that, as opposed to just outlining a treatment and doing it to the patient? So this is all about shepherding the flock. It's about not only treating the patient and the patient as an entire human being, but it's also about treating the family who comes along with that patient, and also the entire healthcare team, which includes the surgeons, the physicians, the nurses, the physician's assistants, and if you're lucky, all the other ancillary services that come along, like social work and pastoral care and psychology and psychiatry. And at the clinic, we have very active healing services and nutrition and physical therapy and occupational therapy, and we can go on and on. There's a large community of people to treat the entire patient. So let's talk about the patient. The first bit of advice is to meet them where they are. I was thinking, when I was asked to give this talk, I was thinking, well, what was my first experience with one of these patients? And the answer was 24 years ago when I started at the Cleveland Clinic, and I was a pain specialist. I was called up to one of the floors to meet with a patient, and so I just sort of started off, well, tell me a little bit about yourself and what you're doing here. Actually, he was in the skilled nursing facility at the time, and he lifted up his gown, and his entire abdomen was open. And I said, oh, how are you dealing with that? And he said, you know what, actually, I'm kind of okay. My wife's kind of freaked out by it at this point, but I'm sort of doing okay. So I knew where to start with him. That hasn't been my case since then all the time. Assess the level of the patient's comprehension. And this needs to be done as an ongoing process, because as the patient's medical condition changes, their comprehension is going to change as well. When we are under stress, no matter how intelligent we are, we lose a massive number of IQ points. And so we need to assess, what is the patient going to understand, and at what level are they going to understand it? Also, assess their readiness to engage with you and how much they want to know. There are patients who want to know everything. There are patients who want to know nothing. But we need to know, what does this patient want? And what do they want right then? Because that may change as well. Also, it's important for us to have a really good understanding of what their premorbid functioning was like and what were their social roles. I've had patients tell me countless times, I'm the caretaker, I'm the provider, I am not the patient. What's killing me is what this is doing to the rest of my family. I am not there for them. I need to be there for them, and that's their biggest struggle. Also, you know, when patients come to us, they already come to us as full-fledged human beings, and they may have a premorbid history of depression or anxiety. They may have chronic pain to begin with and now may have a painful condition on top of that. They also may come to us with serious psychiatric disorders. I remember one of my very first placements in graduate school in clinical psychology was at our state psychiatric facility. And since my field was going to be behavioral medicine, I was complaining to my father, who was a surgeon, and I said to him, you know, I don't want to work in a psychiatric hospital. You know, why do I have to do this? And he said to me, he said, you know, sometimes schizophrenics get sick. And you're going to have to be the one to make that diagnosis. So you need to know what it looks like. Also, particularly these days, we're dealing with an addiction epidemic. And we need to be able to know it when we see it. Because we're going to be giving patients a lot of chemicals that they could very well become addicted to, or they may already be addicted to it. And if, for instance, you have someone who is abusing opioids or benzodiazepines or alcohol or any one of those substances, and you go in and do a surgery on them and you don't know preoperatively about this addiction, and you try and give them the standard post-operative medications of a couple of Percocets, they're not going to say thank you. And also, if they happen to have been on benzodiazepines, you really don't want them on benzodiazepine withdrawal, which can be lethal. So it's important to know this up front about our patients. It's important to know what's going on in their lives. What are their stresses? I had a patient when I asked them about stresses in their lives, and this woman said to me, you know, there really isn't much anything going on, just the normal stuff. And I said, well, you know, I'm not quite sure what normal is. And she said, well, you know, I have one son who's in prison because of drug trafficking, you know, and another one who's living out on the streets, but this has been ongoing for a long time. So from that point forward, I just never accept normal as an answer. We want to know what their prior treatment was and what their prior experiences with their treatment. What kind of coping skills do they bring? I always ask my patients what kind of coper they are, because I want to know whether they're a chemical coper. Do they cope by having an extra single malt scotch? Do they cope by taking an extra Percocet, Xanax, or smoking an extra joint? It's important to know what they use. I'm always very relieved when patients have a go-to coping response that's on the healthier side of things that we may be able to help them with. People who cope using their religious or spiritual beliefs, and we can help them with that, and not have to worry about withdrawal. It's often important to get collateral information, particularly when you're talking about substance use and abuse. In my experience, sometimes patients are not always honest about their use. We're not always honest about our use. It's best to ask someone who's related. Also, it's helpful to introduce self-help strategies. I'm relatively certain within the next decade, virtual reality headsets are going to be mandatory for treatment of any condition when people are in hospitals. It's a great way to make sure that your brain is as far outside the room as it can be. This is research that's shown itself to be valuable decades ago, but it hasn't quite been launched yet. It's coming. And before we get to that, there's also deep relaxation, which is really available readily. And now, you can't see that, maybe you can. It's a website in which I have produced some relaxation recordings. It's Behavioral Medicine Program, Cleveland Clinic. And you can find relaxation recordings there. Also, I ask that you just listen and be present. What patients tell us is they just want to be heard. And don't abandon them, please. That's their biggest fear. So the family, the same rules hold. Meet them where they are. Assess their level of comprehension. As I said, not, you know, when we're under stress, our IQ drops. Patient's family is under equal amount of stress as well. And they may not be remembering things or understanding things that you might expect them to. Also assess their readiness and willingness to engage. And assess their premorbid functioning and their, how are they accepting of their new social roles. Some people may say, I didn't sign up to be a nurse. I'm not here for that. Now, I have to be really careful about how I say this, and believe me, this is on average, it's not everybody, but on average, women will stay with husbands who become impaired. Men, on average, tend to leave. So assess the premorbid psychological factors within the family member as well. The same things hold, because these are the same issues, the same psychosocial factors that are going to affect their ability to help the patient. And introduce self-help strategies for them, distraction, deep relaxation, etc. Once again, listen and be present, and don't abandon the family members either. So here's what we know, and here's what we think we know. Psychosocial variables really are the best predictors of medical outcomes, but often we go into situations not having assessed these. It would be a good idea if we could. Those tools are out there. And that way we could help determine the best treatment for the best patient, getting the right patient to the right provider the first time. So treatment and chronic care of the fistula. What we think we know is that it's psychologically draining for the patient and their families. Actually, when I went in to look for psychological effects, et cetera, there's not a lot out there. There's really no data. There's what we think is happening based on our own experiences and also based on thinking about how we might react if we'd been in that position. But or having told you about my patient who said that, you know, he pretty well adjusted to it. He was fine. But what we think we know is that patients feel isolated, and they live in fear of appliance leaks. They're physically hungry. You know, I was looking at those pictures, and I was thinking, you know, what if you just brought a few people in off the street and watched those pictures? I often wonder about those AV folks who attend these conferences and look at all these pictures, and I think, how are we hurt? Are we damaging these people? But, so most people just aren't used to seeing themselves or anybody else look that way. They also may be angry, depressed, and particularly in our country, financially fearful, because a catastrophic problem like this can bankrupt an entire family, and patients worry about that. So what can we do? Well, we can help with positive coping mechanisms. We can teach family members and the patients about dressing changes to foster a greater sense of independence. It's very hard for people who are used to being independent to now be in a position where they are completely dependent on someone else to do something for them. That's really difficult for a lot of people. We can set short-term achievable goals and measure those goals in a way that the patients can actually track their own progress. When something good happens, we can celebrate that success with the patients, and we can foster a positive attitude and virtual reality. Actually, my go-to, since we don't have virtual reality headsets available in our hospital at this point, I suggest that patients binge watch Netflix. And I suggest to them that they find something with 7 seasons long that has 15 to 25 episodes, and that they keep hitting next episode. And that way they can keep their brain outside the room, because there's nothing inside the room that's going to bring them a lot of joy at this point. So this says surgeons are people too. And that says, now, Marcus, I want you to stop concentrating on Noah's actions and focus on what's in his heart. So this is just saying you should be prepared to deal with the emotions of the patient and their family. They may be really angry. They may blame you. They may be really sad and want to cry. And a lot of us are really uncomfortable sitting with people when they cry. I always have at least two boxes of tissues in any office that I see patients. I think I bring it out in them, but if patients realize it's okay to cry in front of you and that you can be there, they'll appreciate that. And also rejection. But I would urge you, don't just say fine and run, because they're expressing their feelings. They really, it's not you, it's a situation. Disgust, denial, fear, anxiety. Anxiety is a huge one. It plays a tremendous role in terms of our own physiology. And distrust and depression. So, what can you do? You can master the skill of teaching difficult material to compromise students. Remember, IQ points drop. So, one of the things you can do is to repeat, repeat, and repeat. It's kind of like real estate. But just keep repeating, and that's the way that we learn difficult material. Learn the skill of asking open-ended questions, because it's only through asking open-ended questions that we learn whether or not somebody really understood what you said. It's tempting to go in and tell somebody really something that's difficult and then ask, do you have any questions? And my response to that is always, I haven't understood a word you said, and so I can't possibly formulate an intelligent question. So, you know, most people won't say that. You need to ask an open-ended question so that they can demonstrate to you that they do understand. And then provide information in a variety of different formats. There's an extensive literature out there that says that just verbally giving somebody information, they tend not to remember it. Written, you know, you stand a little bit better chance. If it's got pictures and videos and audios and you can do all of those things, then you're likely to find something, some modality that this patient can learn from and their family. And take the time. Please don't ask them to drink from a fire hose. If you give people way too much information at a time, they may remember the first thing you said, and they may remember the last thing you said, and they may forget absolutely everything in the middle. So this says, I guess he made it. It's been more than a week since he went over the wall. So this is just suggesting that you might want to track changes. There are a lot of ways of tracking how successful we've been. Promise Health Measures is one of my favorites. Asking people about their pain levels. I put down in terms of assessing mood, there's a brief survey, depression, anxiety, and stress scale. It's short and it's free. And the Pain Disability Index is another short and free indicator of how much pain gets in the way of your life. And also there are a bunch of quality of life measures. And so it's important to track people along the way to see how you're doing, so they can see how they're doing. And then there are the second victims. This says, whoa, way too much information. So sometimes patients end up telling us things that are overwhelming and injure us as the second victims. So what are the signs and symptoms of the second victims after an adverse medical event? Well, there are physical signs and symptoms, and they include extreme fatigue, although I'm not sure how you differentiate that from normal, increased blood pressure, muscle tension, rapid breathing, rapid heart rate. And then there are the more subtle psychological signs and symptoms, such as sleep disturbances, anger, decreased job satisfaction, to which we might add burnout, which is a real big problem, difficulty concentrating, extreme sadness, fear of repudiation damages and flashbacks, or reputation damages, and frustration, grief, remorse, loss of confidence, and return to work anxiety. Those are things that are really important to pay attention to in ourselves and also for us to look for in our colleagues and address those and see them as things that need help and to be worked on and not to be just sort of shoved away as, you know, buck up. Now, I can't help myself. I spent 21 years as primarily a pain specialist, so I need to talk about a little bit about pain and why pain pills such as opioids alone may not be the answer. And that's because pain is a multifaceted experience. The International Association of Study of Pain defined pain as both a sensory and emotional experience. And so it is not confined to what goes on in the periphery, but rather what also goes on in our brains. But the biomedical model fails generally to address the psychosocial factors that really drive the pain and also drive disability. Because what we know is that pain is, number one, not at all well correlated with the extent of damage in the periphery. We know that. But it is also modified by our thoughts. How do we know this? We know this from functional MRI studies, where you take somebody's head, you stick it in a functional MRI, you image their brain activity while simultaneously doing something painful to them. I don't know why people volunteered for these studies, but because they did, what we were able to find is that pain such as throbbing, aching, sharp, burning, and tingling are perceived in the somatosensory cortex, where descriptors such as agonizing, unbearable, torturing, miserable, killing, excruciating are perceived in different areas of the brain, primarily in the limbic area of the brain. And what we know is that when multiple areas of the brain are actually activated in response to a painful stimulus, we feel more pain. The pain signal is actually amplified. And so when people can learn to shut off that limbic area of the brain, they actually perceive less pain. So the thoughts matter. Context of how and where we are when we perceive the pain matters. And when I think about context, I always think about football, because I've never really understood why anybody would catch a football. Because what happens when you catch a football? You get tackled. And then what do these people do? They get up and they do it again. It's not like they forget that they're going to be tackled, but the context is a game. But if you take that very same person and you change their context to one in which they feel threatened and one in which feels like their life is in danger and they have a less of an injury, it's going to hurt more. Expectations. We as healthcare providers often tell patients what we expect for them to feel, and I think we often err on one of two sides. Sometimes we will say to people, this is really a minor procedure and it's not going to hurt very much. Or we may say to people, this is really painful and it's going to take a long time for you to recover. Either way, I don't think it's very helpful because we're not that patient and we don't know what they're going to experience. And in fact, we never know what we're going to experience at any given time. You may undergo exactly the same procedure multiple times, and it's going to feel different times. So projecting and spending time with expectations of what things are going to feel like may be a waste of time and energy. Now, anticipation of pain can actually lead the brain to send messages downward in the absence of any painful stimulus. And we know this, again, from functional MRI studies, where first we learned this in an animal model, where you teach an animal if the red light goes on, you're going to shock their finger, and their brain lights up prior to the shock. Well, you can replicate this in humans. So we know that anticipation of pain, we can actually perceive it first. So stress causes delayed healing because it induces the fight-flight response, which sends blood to our large muscles and not to our body. It causes increased inflammation, it dampens the immune response, and all of this can be regulated positively by deep relaxation. Comorbid psychiatric illness we've already talked about, except for pain catastrophizing, which is a factor that actually is the best predictor of outcomes of acute transition from acute to chronic pain. So biopsychosocial approaches include education, normalization, and also other psychological approaches like cognitive behavioral therapy, deep relaxation, biofeedback, et cetera. So chronic opioid therapy, benzodiazepines, and sedative hypnotics may not be anybody's friend, so the recommendation is to consider embracing adjuvant medications. So the key takeaways are that psychosocial variables are the best predictor of outcomes. Care for the entire person, the family, the team, and maybe most importantly, yourself. And the last for everyone, just take a deep breath in. Let it out three times longer as you relax. Just relax. Getting more and more, deeper and deeper relaxed. Thank you.